There will be an exam at the end, and if you don't ask questions now.
But we failed
several tests already. I'm not even
joking.
He
can be post-selected. Okay. So I ended the session last time telling you, yesterday, telling you that we have to learn to think about quantum collisions or quantum interactions as always being a combination of local effect, which has classical analog, and non-local effect, which are unique to quantum mechanics. So I want to show you now a very simple but quite general example that shows very clearly these two features. So let's assume in one dimension that we have a particle that is initially in some wave function. So at time t equal to zero, this is the wave function for describing the vector of the particle in the position representation. And the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m. And I suddenly introduce a very sharp force in time that is different from zero just in a given region here. So there's a constant force, it's a small region, fx, that I suddenly switch on and off. The potential describing this is delta of t times theta of x times some v. The derivative of the v in this region is the force. V is a constant here and a different constant here. That's why theta of, if I go to the limit when this distance becomes, this size becomes zero also, it's theta function. Otherwise, this is v that behaves like x here, and then it starts with zero here, and then it goes to some finite. So this is delta t times v of x, where v of x is a function of x. V of x is zero up to the place where the force starts to be there. Then it goes very fast to some finite value, and then it goes constant again, v zero. So we know that what happened to the wave function psi of x, because this is a delta function, it changes immediately from psi of x to psi of x times e to the I v of x. You know that if I put this v of x times theta of t, it was zero up to t equals to zero, and then it jumps to this thing, then the time derivative will indeed be delta of t times v of x. So this is what happens to the wave function immediately after the force was switched on and off, and then from then on, it will continue to evolve freely. Right? Now, if this were a, if instead of quantum particles, I will have here a density of classical particles, then I will say that what happened is all the particles that were inside the range of the force got a kick, and all the particles that were outside were left unaffected at all. And the total momentum given to this liquid will be the constant force here multiplied by the time. So, and multiply by the distance here in order to know how many particles were there. So the total effect will be f delta t delta x. F delta x gives me the difference of the potential here and here. And delta t is this jump delta t. So classically, I will see that there is indeed something proportional to the action. There is a potential times time. But the reason why it's proportional to the action is because I have to take also into account how many particles were in this region. The question is, what is the difference with the effect of this action when it acts quantum mechanically compared to classically. So we can see immediately quantum mechanically there is a big difference if the difference of the potential here and here is a multiple of 2 pi. Because if the wave function psi of x is multiplied by e to the I v of x, v of x here is 0, so the wave function is I of x. We go to v of x here. If it's a multiple of 2 pi, then the wave function does not change at all, right? On the other hand, suppose it's multiple of 2 pi minus a very small amount. That will be completely equivalent from the point of view of the wave function if I introduce instead a force that will give the potential here. Because from the point of view of the wave function, any jumps of 2 pi are irrelevant. So therefore, quantum mechanics tells me something very interesting. I have a positive force. Classically, it will always push the particle to the right. Quantum mechanically, the probability that the particle will be here can go to zero at the limit when this jump is very, very fast. Under this condition, the probability that I had the local effect goes to zero. But I have a non-local effect because of the difference of the phase here and here that behaves periodically as a function of the size of the force. So I increase the force, and lo and behold, the particle actually, all the particles move to the left instead of to the right. Because a change of 2 pi minus epsilon is the same as the change of minus epsilon. A change of minus epsilon is equivalent to a negative force. So if you check carefully what will happen in the extreme case where I have a bunch of forces periodically like this, that I split them all just like this. So I have a bunch of forces like this that were all switched on and off. And they're all positive. So classically, all the particles that will feel the effect will be pushed to the right. And the total average momentum will, of course, be positive. The total average momentum quantum mechanically will also be positive. But it acts in a very interesting way. Those particles that happen to interact locally with this will feel huge cross kick to the right. All the other particles, the majority of them that actually were found in between the forces, will feel a periodic effect to the size of the force. So I keep increasing the force, and in fact, I see that suddenly the majority of particles will move to the left, and very few of them will get huge momentum to the right that on the average will give us the classical effect. So if you study carefully these simple two examples, and I suggest that you really do it carefully, you will see now that we have a situation that becomes sudden, very, when we take forces that are very sharp, that the WKB approximation is not valid, so the classical intuition is not safe. We have forces that are sharp in position, in time, scattering, it happened very quickly. In all those cases, we have a combination of a classical type effect that happens when the particles are actually touching the force, which can be a very small probability, and the rest of the particles behave in a non-classical way, just due to effect of potential or to non-local exchange of modular momentum, and those particles really behave in a very new way, and this really shows us that the issue of non-locality in the quantum interaction is very, very general. It's always there. Every scattering effect will always have a change that can be described by the average momentum, and that is the usual classical way to think about it. This will be valid for the local interaction, and then there is the exchange of modular momentum between the sources and the particles, which behave in a completely new way because of their periodicity. We increase the force and the effect goes in the opposite direction. And it behaves periodically. So this is a new feature of quantum interaction that is caught by modular variables and by the effect that the time derivative of these modular variables are non-local. the parishes that are here know that there was a force here because of the notoriety of the equations of motion for the modulo, and that is the thing why they behave in a way that depends on the force, but in a periodic way, because of the modulo is periodic. And therefore we create the force, and they actually suddenly feel an opposite effect when we go through the quantum amount of fraction. So this is very, very important lesson that if you want to understand really deeply what is new in quantum mechanics, when you do scattering or you do interaction, there is always hidden that modulo effect, which is not caused by just calculating the average of the force and the time dt, saying that that is the momentum given. That is true, but it doesn't tell you what happened to individual particles. In the ensemble, I can get very large change in the average momentum due to extremely small number of particles that are here. They get a huge kick, but it happens very rarely. And in all the other cases, we have particles actually moving in the opposite direction, and that is due to this non-local feature of quantum mechanics. Are there any questions about it? Yes.
Now the photon coming in with the mirror getting out, then there's a shift to the amount. There's the cavity then see the slightly shift. But this shift affected that the periodicity.
Yeah.
Then it doesn't affect the is the negligible.
It's what?
It's negligible. Why don't consider such an effect?
I'm saying that there is a periodic effect.
Yeah.
This
is the original side, L.
This L has nothing to do with.
Oh, yeah.
The L is everywhere here. The force is just in the middle. This is not connected with the uncertainty. I have a wavefront spread everywhere. And I have a force just here.
I see.
And the question is, what does this force do, okay?
Oh, right, yeah.
So, it's different on the particles, on the probability of particles being at the place of the force, and most of the particles are not in the place of the force, theoretically nothing will happen to them. Quantum mechanically, their modular momentum is defined and it's affected by it.
All right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, that area is not connected with this.
Explain this diagram again.
Yeah, okay. Suppose I have now a potential V of x, which is this one. It's essentially nx. It's, say, 0 here, then V0, then 2V0, 3V0, okay, minus V0, minus 2V0, etc. Okay? So the potential V of S is equal to V0 times, remember that I talked about an integer operator nx. So it's nx times L, where L is this distance. Okay? So I have here a potential which involve forces only at this location, okay? The forces are only at the location where the potential jumps. I switch it on and off quickly, okay? Yeah. So I write, in fact, an Hamiltonian, which is delta t times this v of x. So suddenly, the wave function is multiplied by this potential. Now, I claim that classically, at this limit, particle will feel nothing. Because the probability of classical particle will feel the force is zero. Okay? Quantum mechanics, if you calculate the change in the average momentum, it will be very large, because if the force is equal, say, to delta of x times delta of t, let's force say at some point here, okay? Then the dp average dt is equal to the integral of f times delta x times delta t. The average of that in the position of representation. If I have a wave function which is constant, this average, I'm calling here the average. Is the integral? It's the average of f times delta x delta t. Yeah, so well, the average of f, the average of f is simply psi star of x psi x, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so okay, so this is psi star of zero psi zero. So you see that dpdt is large, right? There's also some V0 here or something. Okay, the point is, this is already here, but it is multiplied by V0 here. Okay, so you see dp average dt will be large. This integral dt will be, will integrate this, and we get really a large effect that has no meaning at all, because it comes about from probability zero being here and getting infinite momentum. So it doesn't happen classically.
It's not infinite momentum,
it's finite. No, the passing is actually a dislocation feels infinite force.
Yeah, but
finite
momentum.
Yeah, no, sorry, finite momentum. Yeah, you're right. Okay, but the thing is,
you get a finite.
Actually, you know, I think if I want the average momentum to change finally by finite amount, it's multiplied by the number of particles here times the change of momentum in each one of them. The number of particles here is zero, and therefore the change of momentum in each one of them must be infinite. Because, you see, the number of particles here is not psi 0 psi 0, but it's psi 0 times 0. So the number of particles here is 0, and they nevertheless get finite momentum. So each one of them might get infinite momentum. Okay, think about it. If I have density of particles that is constant here,
yeah.
The number of, suppose this happens in a very, very short interval. The number of particles here,
If you find them there, because you can divide by the probability of finding them there.
Okay, you're right? So I'm right. I'm saying that you can think about this. You can think about it. Yes? Sorry?
Yeah.
In the limit, if I go to the limit, suppose it has a very, very small region of space where there is a very large force. Right? So the force, so every particle inside this region will feel a huge force, and therefore we get a very large momentum. But the number of them will be very small, so the average momentum change for the other ensemble will be finite. But it comes about from smaller and smaller number if I multiply by larger and larger force, okay? So the limit. Both classically and quantum mechanically, there will be an average momentum given this way. For the classical continuum particles or quantum mechanics.
Yes.
And for both of them, that issue of the average momentum will look exactly the same. Also classically, if I have a continuous distribution of density of classical particles, there will be very few of them here, and those will get very large momentum. So as far as analyzing what happened to the average momentum, there is no difference between the classical and the quantum case. In both of them, I understand that at the limit, although I get a huge, a finite average momentum change, no particle felt it in the middle because the number of particles as well here go to zero. So I get that average momentum from smaller and smaller number of particles, getting each one of them bigger and bigger kick. And the limit, no particle got infinite kick. And that's the average momentum, but no particle classically or quantum mechanically would have been affected locally. And that's the end classically. Classically, at this limit, nothing happened. Because there is no aspect of non-locality that is left. But quantum mechanically, if the wave function is multiplied, I have now a wave function that was initially constant, like momentum zero, and now it's multiplied by e to the I v of x. E to the I v of x is zero here. If it's 2 pi here, if it's 4 pi here, then nothing happens. Then the wave function remains unchanged. But if it's, if this real phase is slightly less than 2 pi, then it's the same as if it was negative like this, because multiples of 2 pi don't make any difference. So there is a periodic effect here. And the periodic effect tells me that each time the flux that is included here is an integer number, the flux is f delta h delta t is like a flux. Right? A flux, you know, a flux in general, I can write a flux as f nu nu if I write it in delta h nu, delta h nu. For example, magnetic flux is F12 times delta x times delta y. F12 is the magnetic field in the z direction. So BZ times delta x delta y is a flux of a solenoid. Okay? What happens if I take it, if I look at F0, F01 times delta x times delta t. F01 is the electric field, right, in the x direction. So I see a force times delta x times delta t is like a flux in the xt plane, okay? So what is this story? I have a flux in the xt plane. If it's quantized by integer number, it has no effect at all. The modular momentum is unaffected. If it's not quantized, then there is a periodic effect. The biggest one is when the flux is exactly 1/2, and then it goes periodically. That means that I keep increasing it, causing the effect disappear, I increase a little bit more, it's like a negative flux. Okay? So, we see here a new feature of quantum effect that always is included, in general, together with the classical local effect. And we have to develop intuition to say that in general, in any scattering, there will be some hidden parts that will behave in a non-classical way, according to this kind of description. So it's very important to develop intuition about that feature, okay? Now, and then, and just to remind you, the effect of this non-local feature of the quantum thing is exchange of modular momentum. Because what we discuss here is the change of the modular momentum. Because what if I multiply psi of x by e to the I v of x and calculate the average of the modular momentum, so the average of the modular momentum with PL is compared to phase here to the phase here, because I make a translation. So that means that if I want to understand all the information about the phases here, I have to see how all the modular momentum have changed. And they all have, because for each different L, I will just compare the phases different places. And the average of all these modules with different parameters, each one of them has no local equation of motion, so each one of them knows whether there was a force, knows where the particle is. And that's how this non-local effect comes about. So when we learn to think about the non-local equations of motion of the modular variables, we will develop real intuition about quantum effects that has no classical analog, that are now not just in the case of AB topological effects. They are very universal. They happen in every kind of scattering. They are hidden there. Or not hidden if you understand them. Okay, now. Yes?
Sorry, just a very general question.
Yeah.
Non-local is a very negative word.
Non-local
is very negative.
Okay.
It doesn't define anything.
All right. Yeah.
It's an infinite category.
I know.
Is
okay.
There some more precise language?
Some what?
Some more precise.
Yeah, okay. I'm exactly going to discuss that being with that now. So we see that we have these modular variables that are important. They have three parameters. I can talk about each module L or each module 2L. Let's try to see a little bit more the mathematics of the module variables carefully. So if I look at the operator X, I can always write it as a sum of integer steps plus what is left. So I can write it as an integer operator n is times steps of L, or let me use L0 here. Steps, each one of them is 0, and the remainder is S modulo X0. So if you want to have a picture, here is the position X, here is 0, and suppose I look at a given position here. And I can write that position by first of all adding integer numbers of x0, and what is left here is the x modulo x0, right? So this is n times x0 plus x modulo x0 brings me to the location x. Okay? That's clear? And similarly, I can write px, the operator px, as an integer np times p0 plus p modulo p0. So this is again an integer operator that tells me if I want to come to a given momentum, how many steps I have to make with p0 and the remainder. I want now to see if I can calculate all the commutators of all these things to get some better feelings for what's going on. So the most important commutator that is new here, it has no classical analog. Maybe I should mention that x0 times p0 must be equal to h. That's how I do it. So at the limit, when h goes to 0, one of them must go to 0, and then the thing is defined. Because to look at x modulo x0 when x0 goes to 0, it's something that oscillates infinitely faster, and it has no meaning. So therefore, that new way of looking at the variable x and px is unique to quantum mechanics. Because when x goes to 0, I couldn't do it. And that comes about because I've shown that if I look at the commutator between f, two functions, f of x and g of p equal to 0, there is a solution to this quantum mechanically. But if I want to do the analogous thing classically, which is the Poisson bracket between the two equals to 0, there is no solution. Because for the Poisson bracket to be equal to 0, one of them must be a constant. For the commutator to be equal to 0, it can be periodic. This way, so, and you can see that the sign of that is that indeed if h goes to 0, I cannot satisfy this classically. Okay? So, what are the commutation relations then? So the first thing is that x modulo x0 commute with p modulo p0. The commutator is equal to 0 because these are functions, periodic functions. And,
x0 p0 to
h1. Yeah, h or h bar, I don't know what you have to do. Yeah, only for, yeah, but. Okay, so I have now, it suggests that for each parameter x0, there is an interesting way to go to something between x being definite or px definite. I can find something in between that makes both of them definite. It's also a non-degenerate representation in one dimension. And there are infinite ways of doing it, depending on which parameter I'm choosing. And none of them is classical. All of them are just different classical way of analyzing phase space in this new kind of structure. So that thing that we say, that we know X mode and P mode, means that if we look in phase space, if this is phase space, x and px, I choose a parameter x0, and I look now at x by looking at all the positions where I go into the number of x0 in both ways, and I put lines like this. So these are the lines where x modulo x0 is equal to 0. And then I choose in the momentum, I choose a line like this. And these are the lines where P modulo P0 is equal to 0. So this is equal to 0 and P equal to 0. They look, here it looks more or less like, they don't have to have equal lengths, of course. It's just a mistake of this picture. But anyhow, so what this tells me is that I can know exactly where the particle is inside each one of these areas, but I don't know at all at which place it is. So I have now a new representation where I know the modulo locations in phase space, and the total area goes to H. Each one of them have zero area, but there is infinite number of them. The total area goes to H, and I will show you later that if I take now no points, but some little areas here, I will have to add up total number of areas that will be equal to H. That will be the general way to look at what happened. So I have three kinds of limits. One limit is that if I know x, so I'm completely on this line. Another limit is if I know p, that's completely on this line. Then there is another possibility that I try to know as much as I can about x and p. Delta x and delta p are of the same order. That's more or less covering just one of these cells. Not exactly sharp because I have cells, but that's the usual way that we interpret the Gaussian, the usual picture of going from classical physics to quantum mechanics, saying instead of having a point, I have a spread point, like a wave packet. And indeed, one wave packet, that is the thing that we can describe usually by WKB approximation, and it gives us a picture that's quite classical, the motion of wave packet. But now we go to the other extreme, the quantum extreme, where we are looking at this limit where I have these points given. They correspond to preparing a state of a particle going through an infinite grating. If I have a grating in two dimensions, I have a grating with holes here, a distance and a part in this direction. And I start initially a particle with zero momentum in this direction. Okay? And it moves like this. I have no information about the position of this particle, and I know exactly its momentum along this line. Now, suppose the particle is very narrow in the other direction. It passes by and goes very quickly through this thing. So the minute when it passes by here, I have contribution here, I have contribution here. It didn't have a chance yet to spread. I have all this contribution. Now, what do I know about this contribution? First of all, I now know x modulo L. Right? I don't know what x is, but I know x modulo L is known. The momentum was initially zero. If I have a periodic potential, I know that I can make a jump in the momentum only by integer times h over L. That means that when the particle goes through here, I know the modulo position, and I know also about the modulo momentum. So that is the most extreme quantum case where instead of having just one wave packet, you have infinite number of separate wave packets. And this is the extreme where you know x modulo and p modulo, right? Of course, the general situation will be just a finite number of them. And we'll discuss this in a minute when we continue to look at the commutation relation. Any questions so far? Okay, so let's continue to look at the commutation rate.
Because,
yes.
Is there going to be any problem with the Liouville theorem here?
Why?
Well, you have these cells, right?
Yeah.
So if you want to see the volume of the block in the phase space conserved, are you saying that you're going to be restricted only to one cell?
No, I'm going to show you, as I said, if you wait, you will see. I'm going to show you that I can either have, classically, I can either have an initial situation where I have a classical distribution of points of initial condition that has an area of H. That is the usual thing. Now I say I can split this into separate smaller areas that will sum up in the area to H, but they will be split. So for example, I can have in this situation, I will show from the commutation relation, I can have a situation where I have this area and this area and this area and this, etc. You will see that there will be a meaningful from the commutation relation. I could arrange a situation with that the sum of all these areas will be exactly equal to H. That's how the analogous to the Wiens theorem, simply meaning that I just choose the same area in phase space. Now, if you ask how can I go from this to this continuously, I can't. I need jumps. And jumps are given only by quantum mechanics. If I have a periodic potential V of X, it will make jumps in the momentum from here to here, and there is no classical analog to that. So I can't have classically a flow that will go from this state to this state. That is quantum mechanically. But I can preserve the area. That is okay. So you will understand more about it when I discuss more the commutation rate. I suggest that we have now intermission, and then we continue, okay? Well, in the mathematics. A question here, can you listen? Yeah.
Any run over the derivation of why there's modular
variables? Okay, the question is, can I remind you all, if you forgot, how do I prove that x modulo x0 and p modulo p0 commute if I know that x0 times p0 is equal to h? So the way to prove it is the following. If I know that p modulo p0 is known, that means that I know a periodic function of momentum, because p modulo p0 as a function of p is a periodic function. It goes like this. Right? So this is a periodic function of momentum because after any step of p0, it repeats itself. Meaning that I know that f of p is equal to f of p plus p0 if p modulo p0 is known, right? It's a periodic function. Any periodic function can be expanded in a Fourier series if f of p is equal to f of p of plus p0, then I know that I can write f of p as an integer, as a sum from n equal to minus infinite to n equal to infinite, a n e to the I n p over p0 times 2 pi. Because each one of those, of course, changed by integer times 2 pi when p goes to p plus p0. So this is, of course, a periodic function. And you can show that you're not allowed to put any other Fourier component because that will not be periodic. So I know that every periodic function can be expanded this way, right? Okay. Now, I know that p0 is equal to h over p0. So I can write this e to the I n p over p0 times 2 pi. I can write it as
x0.
Yeah, I know that x0 is h over p0. So then I can replace the p0 here by h over x0. And I will have here e to the I n p over h. Instead of, yeah, this is, I have here x0, and the 2 pi I can bring down, and then I will have h bar. So this is equal to e to the I n p x0 over h bar. And if I think about p now as an operator, then this will be a sum of operators, which instead of writing it like this, it will be a sum of operators, f of p, the operator f of p, will be a sum of operators AN e to the IN, the operator P, multiplied by E0 divided by H bar. This is the same sum, right? Yeah? Now, each one of these is a translation operator in the position representation by N times H0. Therefore, if I look now at the cognitive, if I remember now that V0, that I look now at the function H model is 0. This is a function which is periodic with respect to x0. This is this function, as a function of x. So if I call this a function f of x, this function satisfies that f of x is equal to f of x plus x0, right? So therefore, if I take the commutator of any one of these with f of x, it's equal to f of x plus nx0 minus f of x, and that is equal to 0. Therefore, that commutator commutes with any function which is periodic with respect to x0. And x modulo x0 is a particular function like this. So p modulo p0 and x modulo x0 are function of p and function of x that are both periodic, with their periodicity such that x0 times p0 is equal to h. It could be equal to n times h, but given h. Now, it's much more difficult. In fact, I told you when I talked about it to try and prove that these are the only solution to f of x and g of p commutator equal to 0. That is more difficult to do, and I still urge you to try and do it. If by the end of the period you will not be able to do it, I will show you how to do it. Okay, so now the question is, prove that only for functions that are periodic with this condition, only those will have commutator that are equal to 0, no other. So therefore, the modular variables are unique in that sense that they give us a structure in phase space that is unique, and no other structure exists apart from that one. So we want to continue to see the commutation relation between these operators. So I remind you, I have x is equal to nx times x0 plus x modulo x0, and p is equal to np times p0 plus p modulo p0. Well, all these are operators. These are integer operators. They have only integer eigenvalues. And these are operators that only go from 0 to x0, and they will continue. So I can think about these operators essentially as an angle operator, because, and this is like angular momentum. This has integer values, and this goes from 0, I mean, final thing. In fact, I will show the commutation relation between this and that are exactly as if this is an angular momentum, this is an angle, and the commutation relation between this and that are also action and angle variables. These two angles commute with each other, and the only thing that is left is to know what is the commutation relation between this and that. But I did not prove yet that this and that are like action and angle variables, but I propose, I anticipate that I will prove it. In fact, I'm quite sure I'm going to prove it. There is no big uncertainty there. Okay, so let's see what we can do. I remember that the operator P is equal to minus I H bar DDX, PX. If I look at the operators in the position representation, in the position representation, Px is derivative, and x is like the number x, right? If I have a vector in Hilbert space, and I write it as an integral of psi of x times x dx, well, these are eigenvectors of position, then I know that if I want to know what the operator x does to psi, I bring the operator x inside, but it's x on this, it gives me the number x, And therefore, the operator x acting on psi is the same as the number x acting on the amplitude of expansion. On the other hand, if I look at the operator p acting on psi, I can go to the momentum representation, and then it will be x like a number if we multiply the Fourier transform of this by the number p, but then I don't put Fourier transform it back here, it's the same as derivative. So the operator p times the vector in Hilbert space is the same as the derivative with respect to x on the amplitude in the expansion on this, okay? So that's how we do calculation in the position representation. We know that if we have any operator p, we replace it by derivative, any operator x, we replace it by a number, okay? So let us see what is the commutator between p and nx. How do I calculate that? Well, there are two different ways of doing it. One is to say that I know that the commutator between p and x is I. And therefore, I can calculate the commutator between p and nx by calculating first the commutator between p and its modulus, because I know the commutator with the sum. So let's see if I can first of all calculate the commutator between p and x modulo x0. So if I look at x modulo x0, now I look at them as numbers because I'm in the position representation. So this is the function, this function, which is now a function of variable x, which is a number because I'm in the position representation. And the px is minus I h bar times the derivative of that. So I simply have to take the derivative of this, and that will be the commutator. The commutator is this thing, the derivative of this with respect to x. Because if I write the operator p times x modulo, in fact, the operator p times any function of x, I want to calculate this. The way I calculate is to say I apply this to any arbitrary function in Hilbert space. So I take p times f of x commutator. It is p times f of x times psi of x minus f of x times p times psi of x. I took here the commutator and see what it does when it takes on any function. Because if I know what it does when it takes on any function, I know what separates operator thing. When p is here, it acts on this, so it will be df dx times psi plus f of x times the psi dx. But the f of x times the psi dx will be cancelled by this. So the only thing that I will be left here is the derivative of x with respect to f of respect to x times I h bar. So this is the commutator. So I know, therefore, that the commutator of p with x modulo x0 is simply the derivative of this function with respect to x multiplied by I bar. So what is this derivative? It's equal to I times h bar. Let's for a minute take h bar to be equal to 1. So the derivative is I minus a set of delta, periodic set of delta function. Because when I come to here, I have to jump to here. So therefore, p, the commutator of p modulo x0 is equal to minus I h bar minus I think there's a minus ix bar outside, and there will be one here from this part, and then there will be minus delta from here. So it will be one minus a periodic delta of x module x0. Each time x module x0 is equal to 0, there is a jump in delta function, right? So this is a shorthand notation times a periodic array of delta functions. What?
No, x minus n.
Huh?
Minus n.
What is that?
It's at location n x0 that you have the delta function.
Yeah.
At
integers.
So it's no. X minus n x0, no?
X module x0 is equal to 0 are all these set of points.
Yes. The set of points are n x0.
The set of points where x module x0 is equal to 0.
Okay.
It's another way to write it.
Okay.
Yes. That's the only way to write first. I can't write n x equal to 0 because, no, it's just, that's the only way to write it.
Then we Yeah, okay.
No, but still not correct.
Has
to have x naught in front of it.
What?
X naught in front of the delta function. Because the height of the jump is x naught.
Yeah, you're right.
In front of the delta function, have x
naught. Yeah, but that's the, yeah, you're completely right. And this is a periodic set of delta functions. And indeed, each time I come there, I have to make a jump by x0. So thank you, you're completely right. OK. Now, what happens if I take the commutator of P? OK, let's first see that this indeed I want to show that this is indeed the same as. Okay, wait with this. Okay, now I want to calculate the commutator of P with nx. So nx is this function. Nx as a function of x is, let's do it like this, 0 here, then it's 1 here, then it's 2 here, minus 1 here, minus 2 here. So therefore I see that the commutator between this and this, which is minus ih, the derivative, is simply a set of positive delta function, okay? So in fact, the commutator of P with nx times x0 is exactly the opposite of this, because it's a sum of x0 multiplied by positive delta function, right? So when I add the two together, this thing is canceled, and I'm left just with minus ih bar, which is exactly the commutator between x and p. So let's summarize what we have so far. The commutator of px with x is equal to minus ih bar. That means that the commutator of px with nx times x0 plus the commutator of p with x modulo x0 is equal to minus I to minus I is bound. And we have seen now that the combination of px with nx times x0 is simply equal, this thing is simply equal to x0 times delta of x modulo x0, where this is a shorthand notation for the sum of delta functions at all the locations where x is equal to integer times x0. This is this part multiplied by, I guess, by minus I h bar. So I have to, I take the minus I h bar outside, I have a contribution like this. Let me write it there. So the commutator of P, I repeat it again, it's important, with x is equal to minus I h bar. And this is the sum of two contributions, commutator of P with nx, nx times x0 plus the commutator of P with x modulo x0. This commutator, we have shown, is minus I h bar times x0 delta of x modulo x0. Where again, I remind you, this is a sum of delta functions at all the locations of x being equal to n times x0, that where x modulo x0 is 0. And then I have another contribution. Another contribution of P with x modulo x0, and we saw that it is equal to minus x0 times the delta function, the same delta function, plus 1. So this cancels that, and we are just left with minus I h bar, as we should, okay? Now I want to show that that commutation relation is exactly the same that would happen if I would have an angle, sorry, this thing. I want now to prove that if I look at the commutator of NP times P0 and X modulo X0, that this commutator will be equivalent to a commutator between angular momentum, since this is an integer, this is like angular momentum, and this will serve like an angle. So if I look just at NP without this, this will be an integer now up to h bar, and I will show that this and that have exactly the same correct commutation relation for action and angle variable, angular momentum and angle variable. You know what? I leave it to you now as an exercise. You prove it for based on what we have shown so far. Try to prove it. If you don't do it, on Monday we will be able to show you, okay? Prove now that this, if I take it into the I x modulo x0, that is the same as an angle because it's periodic, that's very easy to show that this commutator was that, will be exactly the same. The commutator of nz and e to the I phi is equal simply to I e to the I phi up to a sign, right? So we have to show that if I take this operator, and instead of taking this operator, I can take the operator p, because np is equal to p minus p modulo, but p modulo commutes with it. So the operator p, and you take the e to the I of that, it's just a derivative, you will see that it's actually very easy to prove that it acts like an action angle variable. So I don't want to spend more time on it. Try to prove it yourself, okay? If you don't are not able to do it, we'll do it on Monday. Okay. So we see now that if we come back to our picture in the phase space, when we divided the phase space into cells of distance x0 here and p0 here, and we have cells like this, So now we find that we can do the following thing. We can take, for example, things x0 like an angle, x modulo x0 here, x like an angle for np here. That means, for example, that if I will take here a probability distribution that is different from 0, like this. Instead of having a point, I will have a distribution like this. Where I have an uncertainty in this angle, which is equal to that. That angle can be along here, and that angle can be along here. So that means that if this is equal to half of that, it means I have to go in this direction to two steps, because this is like x and angle variable. The number of cells I have to take here multiplied by the width in that direction is exactly has to be equal to h bar. So I'm now talking very fast, purposely. I want you to, after you have shown that indeed the number in this direction is equal like an angular momentum for the angle in this direction, that means that we have something like delta LZ, delta phi, is order of one. That means that the more uncertainty I take in the angular momentum, I can squish the angle more, right? There is some sort of uncertainty between x and angle variable. That means if I take this uncertainty bigger, that means I take more cell in this direction, because that's the integer in this direction. There's the angular momentum that the angle is in the module in this direction. So the more cells I take in this direction, the smaller I can take the range here. The more cells I take in this direction, the smaller I can take the range here. So I can collect the total number of cells like this. I can collect the total area to be h by saying that if this distance is half that, I have to take two cells here. If this distance is a quarter of that, I have to take four cells here. Then the sum number, total number of cells, total areas will be equal to h. I suggest that after you convince yourself that these are like x and angle variable, then you can convince yourself later that this is the correct picture. If you are not able to do it by Monday, we will do it together. This I leave for you as an exercise. Okay, now I want to show more examples of non-local effects quantum mechanics. Let us look at a particle that is confined, for simplicity, in two dimensions, that is confined to move in a very narrow ring like that. So the particle is confined to move only inside here. I know that the kinetic energy of the particle, if I in the direction r, I force the particle to be just in the lowest mode, it's very, very narrow, so I can forget about the energy in the r direction, the kinetic energy, because it's fixed. And the only energy I'm interested in is the rotation energy. And the rotation energy is p theta square. P theta square, this is the angular momentum here, divided by 2i, 2m r square. Okay? This is the whole Hamiltonian for this particle. And the solution is very trivial. I know that p theta must be integer, so there are discrete energy levels, which are integer times h bar divided by square and square divided by this. Now suppose I put here, there is inside here a solenoid with a given flux that is not integer. Then the Hamiltonian now will be p theta minus e over c a theta square. And if that flux has integer number of fluxons, a single fluxon is the unit of flux, which is CH divided by E. If I have this is the minus, now, if I have if the integral of A theta is the flux, so A theta is actually proportional to the flux. And therefore, if I put here A theta equal to CH over E, the C over E will cancel the E over C here, and we get here simply N times H, depending on the number of, if you, that means that I can cancel exactly with the P theta. So I can get zero for the energy if the amount of flux here is integral times this. Because when integral times this, what enters here is NH, I can choose P theta to be equal to NH, and that will cancel, give me zero. But if that is not an integral, suppose what I get here is P theta minus 1/2 H, for example, square over 2 mR square. Because I have half a unit of flux there, then this now suddenly has a minimum energy, which is a 1/2 H square. It degenerates. It could be P theta equals to 0 and P theta equals to H. We give it two degenerate ground states where there is a minimum energy. If I choose any other flux, then what enters here is the flux modulo number of fluxon. There will be some number here which is equal to the flux modulo fluxon. So this goes from 0 to 1. And for any number here different from integer, there must be a minimum energy that is different from 0. So suddenly we see here a non-local effect. Classical particles that will move here will know nothing about this magnetic field inside. It's far away. But quantum mechanically, we see now that there is a minimum energy that this particle will have if there is a flux where the particle never touches. So again, it's a non-local effect of the magnetic field here that affects the behavior of the particles here. And that effect is extremely important when we look at superconductors. You know that if you have a superconductor with a hole in the middle, here's a superconductor. Again, it's symmetric in the z direction, so I forget about it. And I assume what will happen if this superconductor, I put some flux here in the hole. The superconductor is here. Here you must have zero magnetic field, Meissner effect. And you assume what will happen if there is a non-integer flux here. If there is non-integer flux here, we know that we can think about the ground state of the superconductor as having many, many pairs of pairs of particles that have charge E that move together as if they are bosons. So the ground state will be all the pair of particles that have charge 2E, they all go to the ground state. But the problem is that if this flux is not integer, each one of them now must have a minimum energy. And this will be an energy, the total energy will be proportional to the volume, or to the area. So it pays for them to produce an extra current here that will augment this together to have a flux here of a unit H, and then all the other particles can go to the ground state with zero energy. So you pay energy of an area and you gain energy of a volume. That's why a superconductor, when you reduce the energy to zero, you have a flux here, and then you take this thing and reduce the temperature until it becomes a superconductor. Automatically, because it has variation, it will choose to collapse to the lowest energy state by producing a current here that will augment it to an integer flux, and that's how it will go to the ground state. So that is why you find that each superconductor can have only integer number of flux enclosing them. All right, because of the competition between volume energy compared to surface energy. And the first one that explained this Knightley was young, together with his students, I don't remember, a woman student, I don't remember them now. They say that based on the ABFS, they can explain that experimental says that the structure must be quantized by using this argument. Okay, you have any question about that? This is a beautiful macroscopic effect of non-local quantum effect of magnetic field. That magnetic field here affects non-locally all the particles here, and because by this effect it causes them all to go to some minimum energy, they immediately say, oh, it's much better for us to produce a current here, surface current, that will complete it to an integer flux, and then all the rest can go back to zero. And that's what the superconductor does, right? Okay. And now, before, at the finish of this session, I want to tell you about the paradox connected with that bothered me for quite a number of years, and I went around talking to all the great physicists that I could meet. I will tell you immediately their names. Nobody could solve this for a while, until I finally understood how to think about it. But let me show you the paradox. I know that if I have, I can think of a source of flux, not as a solenoid, but as a Gedanken experiment, I can think of a source of flux the following way. Suppose in two dimensions, or in three dimensions, suppose I have a cylinder here, long cylinder like this, on which there is homogeneous charge smeared on it, okay? With constant. So if this ring is at rest, not rotating, it just produces an electric field everywhere, and I can cancel this electric field by another ring similar to that with opposite charge. So imagine I have two rings like this next to each other that can rotate relative to each other, and they have constant homogeneous charge present there. So now if I make them rotate relative to each other, I will produce a magnetic flux in the middle, because if a ring with charge is rotating, it produces a magnetic field inside, and there will be only magnetic field inside that is proportional to the angular momentum of the rotation of one of them. Suppose, for simplicity, let me assume that I have just one ring, and in the middle I have just a line of the opposite charge. So if this ring is at rest, the Coulomb field of the line and the Coulomb field of the smeared charge outside will cancel each other, okay? Inside there is an electric field, but I'm not worried about it. I'm only looking outside. Now, if this thing rotates with some angular velocity, it produces a flux which is proportional to the angular velocity. So then I can think about this thing being in the superposition of two different rotations, either one angular momentum or another momentum. So I have now a superposition of two different fluxes. For one flux, I will have one integral of ADL. For a different flux, I will have a different integral of ADL. So if I do, I send electrons now, and they produce eventually interference pattern. From this interference pattern, I will be able to know what is the angular momentum here. So I made a measurement of the flux, and therefore a measurement of the angular momentum by this experiment. If I measure the angular momentum, I must be able to produce a change in the velocity. Because by superposing different angular momentum, I could have a different angle for this cylinder. And by the end, when I finish my experiment, I picked up one angular momentum, so that angle has become completely uncertain. So how? The electrons don't feel any force of this. But this must be feeling a force due to electrons for the angle to change. How did it happen? If I have an electron moving here, suppose I start at zero and I make it move like this. So when I change the velocity of this electron, it changes the magnetic field inside. Changes the magnetic field inside, it produces an integral of electric field here, electric force here. And if it goes this way, it produces a force in the opposite direction. So though that thing doesn't do anything to the electron can produce a force and needs to change the angle. To understand how this happens more easily, let us look at the electric AB effect. Suppose I have just two lines in two dimensions, two lines of, this is a line of positive charge, and this is a line of negative charge, and they are infinite lines. Then I know in two dimensions that there will be a force inside, but no force outside, because if this is infinitely long, the electric field here from doesn't depend on the distance, so the electric field here from the positive thing is cancelled by electric field from the negative thing, and I'm left only with electric field inside, right? So electron outside, we don't feel any force at all. On the other hand, the electron attracts this one and pushes this one. So it affects the two of them. In fact, it gives them relative angular momentum. So we have an example that similarly is against action, action reaction. The electron feels nothing, but this system feels something, okay? And it's based on this thing that Frey and Ramsey were able to show that there must be an AB effect. I will explain this to you next time, but because I want to finish this paradox. So you see, here's an example where the electron can introduce, can measure the relative distance between this and that, because the phase difference between here and here depends on the distance between the two lines, right? The bigger the distance, the bigger the potential difference, because the potential difference is the integral of the charge times the distance. So in fact, by doing this interference experiment, I can measure the relative distance between them. That means that I must introduce uncertainty in the relative momentum. And indeed, the electron does introduce uncertainty in the relative momentum because it pushes this way, this way. It can change the relative momentum depending on how long this experiment lasts. So this is an example where the electron introduces a force on this, and it can change some observables here without this doing anything to the electron. So similarly here, I do interference experiment here, and I can measure with this interference experiment, I can collapse the angular momentum of this from a superposition to one of them, depending on the results of the interference, and that must introduce, because of the motion of electron, enough changes of this that will make the angle uncertain, just like we've done, we've looked there. Now comes the paradox. And this is a very stubborn paradox. Because suppose that this thing is inside the hole of a superconductor. Now, the superconductor can be of one kind of charges, and the thing that is smeared here can be a different kind of charges, okay? So, or the thing that moves outside doesn't have to be the same charge as the charge inside. I wouldn't be able to prove in this way that all the charges in the universe must be multiple of each other. Okay, let's assume that there are two kinds of charges, or before that, even before that, I know that this flux must be integer from the point of view of the charges that move in the superconductor. But because they are pairs, what is integer for them can be half integer for the electron outside, right? So I can set here a superposition of integer and half integer fluxes that those things would not mind because they will be the ground state. But the electron will be able to measure whether it's an integer number or half integer. So this electron, by doing the experiment here, must change something inside. But what's very interesting is if I have a superconductor here, it does not block the integral of the vector potential outside to be there will still be an integral of vector potential outside, the electron feels what happens outside. But when the electron moving, it cannot penetrate anything inside. The thing inside cannot know the electron is moving outside because no field of the electron, nothing can penetrate inside. So, per definition, any experiment I'm doing outside could never affect the cylinder inside. But it must affect it because I do a measurement of it. So this is a paradox. Very tough paradox. This affects that. This cannot affect that back. This affects that so that I can measure the rotation here. And in fact, this is only two versus one, but I could imagine later that we have two kinds of charges, E1 and E2, that in principle don't have to be multiples of each other. I would be able in this way to prove that something like this doesn't exist. There might be some argument. So the minute there are, the charges here are different from that, I can have superposition of many different angular momentum, and the electron outside will pick one of them by interference. And there is no way it can do it, because by picking one of them, it must introduce some changes inside. And it is not allowed to do it because it moves outside, nothing penetrates inside, no field. So this is a good place to stop this talk, and I expect you on Monday to come with a solution to this paradox.
Is it resolved by the is that resolved by just finite extent and the interaction of the
superconductor? No, because superconductor can be closed source like this and the flux is inside. No. There's nothing. It's not trivial like that.